what the certain sections of the international community are saying is that Mr. de Klerk should be rewarded because he has done something to deserve that. And the first difficulty I have about that is that Mr. de Klerk has done nothing. We have done something. What are you rewarding him for? That's the first question.
Well, let me try and give the answer and have you respond. Your release, the release of other political prisoners, the recognition of the ANC, of the South African Communist Party, now the lifting of the state of emergency in all provinces but Natal, those are actions which the ANC and your supporters have been asking for many years, and some people would say, as each of these demands is met, the ANC is moving the goalposts on the field.
Now, Mr. Koppel, you are entirely misinformed. In the first place, the ANC ought never to have been banned. Secondly, my comrades and I ought never have been sent to prison. The state of emergency ought never to have been imposed. You are crediting Mr. de Klerk for rectifying his own mistakes, his own injustices. You must remember that in enforcing apartheid, many of our people have been killed. And many of our people have been executed for resisting a policy which the government now admits is an evil system. What are you rewarding him for as against that background?
Welcome. Here to move the goalposts, as always, Matt Leck with me, David Griscomini.
How's it going, brother? Really looking forward to this one.
Me too. We got a jam-packed show for you. A last live one before we take a little break. A little break for you, but a full helping already. A feast before, you know, the feast, I guess. And I'm very excited. We'll have later in the show, and let me just transition out of our intro section here. Later in the show, we will have Jacob from the Valley Labor Reporters join us. Mm-hmm. We'll be getting an update on the Warrior Met situation. Attack on free speech, once again, of striking workers. Doesn't get the attention I think it should. It's again happening. Say, you basically... I'm getting a little bit of feedback, but I'll deal with this later. David, if you could take over, I got a little feedback.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, we're going to be joined a little bit by Jacob talking about Warrior Met, the ongoing strike there. They took the fight directly to BlackRock, which is really, really exciting. Ways you can support that and the way that the government and the state now are coming at these striking mine workers. And a little bit after that, Matt is going to be doing a live debunk of everyone's least favorite rambunctious young rascal, Ben Shapiro, talking about IQ and people's brains. We have some words of wisdom from the great Stephen Jay Gould for that as well. And then plenty more of the postgame. In the postgame, too, I'm talking a little bit about Beto, his campaign for Texas governor. We're also going to be breaking down just what's going on at the University of Austin, and then much, much more.
The University of Austin, Texas, is, I think, what we should call it. Pinker knows when to, catch a flight out of there, if you know what I'm saying. So, we're very much looking forward to that. Patreon.com/leftreckoning. But first, we have, as per the intro section there with Nelson Mandela, mm-hmm. We are going to discuss the death of Frederick Willem de Klerk, with our buddy William Shockey of Africa is a Country. Will, thank you so much for joining us at very early hours of the morning over there.
No worries at all. And I mean, just hearing what you guys have in store, takedown of Ben Shapiro and Beto O'Rourke, who I had completely forgot existed. I might stay up for a bit just to catch that. So yeah.
Oh, you're too sweet.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. So we have these headlines. Fred Willem de Klerk, I took some notes, born 1936. To an influential Afrikaner family. And the New York Times recently did the headline, "What is this? F.W. de Klerk, South Africa president who ended apartheid, dies at 85. Now, what is wrong with this headline, Will?
I mean, I think the first obvious thing is attributing the end of apartheid, which was this really devastating campaign of segregation and systemic inequality and the subjugation of black people that began in 1948, but obviously had a longer historical process leading up to it, beginning with colonialism and the dispossession of black South Africans, and which had a fierce resistance, led by multiple political forces, which culminated in the African National Congress, pretty much leading the resistance towards the twilight of apartheid, and F.W. de Klerk being the president at the time of the National Party, who acceded to a lot of the mounting pressures building domestically and internationally. And then for the New York Times, as the New York Times does, to credit the end of apartheid to the sole individual. It's bad enough crediting the end of apartheid to any individual, but to credit it to a person who supported apartheid, who was a top leader of the National Party, not only while he was president, but in the preceding regime of P.W. Botha, which is known for how brutal it was. And then to say that this figure is the guy we have to thank is just outrageous. And I think the backlash in South Africa was swift. And I think it's very interesting to note the contrasting receptions to F.W. de Klerk's passing. In South Africa, it's pretty much unanimous. A lot of people despise him. A lot of people easily understand the way he didn't deserve the Nobel Peace Prize that he won. The Nelson Mandela clip that you played earlier is something that is quite popular here. So I think contrasting that with how the international press was just very quick to kind of reach for this I don't know what the word for it is, but to just embrace him as this struggle hero pretty much was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I would like, because I do think that the reaction within South Africa, I want to hear a little bit more about that in a second, but just like briefly for, you know, some of our audience, you know, are younger and, you know, and are American and might not be familiar, like this was somebody who had like direct hand in like really brutal state crackdown on folks, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, F.W. de Klerk was this Afrikaner man who was born to an elite Afrikaner family and basically throughout his life was groomed to lead the apartheid state, the government that he served in, as I was saying earlier, for P.W. Botha. He had successive ministerial positions and was handpicked by the National Party elite to be P.W. Botha's successor. And I mean, when you serve in P.W. Botha's government, that must mean you have to be not only a supporter of apartheid, but a particularly repugnant individual, because the crackdown against the mounting resistance, especially during the 70s and the 80s, during which P.W. Botha reigned, was incredibly brutal. It was a period that saw high numbers of political killings, mysterious disappearances of lots of families who were targeted in extrajudicial killings. As the apartheid state started to crumble, so did the repression start to exacerbate. And he oversaw that, he participated in that, he was complicit in that, and he took over on the presumption that he would continue to lead an apartheid state. And it was only because of mounting internal resistance and international pressure, which had started to reach a zenith with sanctions crippling the South African economy, that he realized that the pragmatic thing to do would be to bow to that pressure. And that's all he did. All he was a vehicle through which building historical process could happen. But it didn't take any sort of individual exceptionalism on his part to make those decisions. Anyone in his place would have probably decided the same. He just so happened to be the one. He could have come into power in P.W. Botha's stead. In fact, the prime minister that preceded Botha, John Vorster, had actually wanted de Klerk to be his successor. So just incredible to see anyone anywhere praise him.
My understanding is
the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, and my understanding is he's been obstructionist post-ending apartheid. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing to understand about that transition period is that the National Party played a particularly intransigent role. So as South Africa was trying to figure out what its post-democratic future was going to be, design a new constitution, figure out the basic structure of the new state, the National Party was incredibly difficult to negotiate with because they demanded a whole bunch of wild and unrealistic things be featured in the new constitution. I think something that they insisted on is that they actually wanted there to be a series of rotating presidencies in the new South African state so as to ensure that there would be protection of minority interests in the transition period. They insisted on a liberal market economy and the protection of property rights, so on and so forth. And after a lot of back and forth and a really protracted negotiation period, once the democratic elections happened and a government of national unity was put in place with Nelson Mandela serving as the first democratically elected president, F.W. de Klerk was actually his president for 2 years. And even then, he was extremely obstructionist, as you correctly pointed out. He, for example, objected to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission happening, which was this process which was envisioned in order to try and investigate the crimes against humanity which were committed during apartheid, to find those who were culpable, and if they required prosecution, for them to be prosecuted, and if they presented the required level of remorse, for them to be granted amnesty. But he insisted that everyone be granted amnesty. And something else which I think is also important to highlight is that prior to the first democratic government, in that negotiation period, as I was mentioning earlier, there was tremendous political tension and there was violence that completely racked the country as different political groups were sort of jockeying for a way to assert their vision of the post-democratic future. And this was violence that implicated the ANC, it implicated other forces. But what the Gladys government did is fan the flames. They had control of the security apparatus, and rather than preventing the violence, often the security apparatus would participate in the violence, would supply different vigilante and political groups with ammunitions, and would contribute to a lot of the devastation which happened. And this is something that he flatly denied. This is something Nelson Mandela directly accused him of. And into the post-democratic period, just continued to refuse to accept any culpability, not only in his participation in all of the strife, but also to acknowledge that, you know, apartheid was a crime against humanity, even up until his passing.
Yeah, I mean, I did want to note that, you know, somebody who was very, very fixated, it seems, on his legacy, you know, including, after he passed away, releasing a video you know, posthumously, apologizing in a way you have to watch people. I should have prepared it, but people should watch the video because he's very careful about what he says. He definitely seems like somebody who, yeah, later in his life was very interested in making sure that he was going to be remembered in this way, correct? Like this, the kind of reaction that you're seeing in the New York Times and a lot of international press of this was what he was trying to achieve. And I have to say, like, watching the video that he released, I think it's very manipulative, not only in the way that he's sort of dancing around saying anything of real substance, but too, it's like, you know, it's a frail older person, clearly at the edge of their life. You know, it really is trying to pull on your heartstrings. You know, and if you don't know the context, it might be successful. Mm. But the context is this is somebody who oversaw an extremely brutal regime and then afterwards, you know, was defending it and trying to slow down truth and reconciliation and the kind of healing that was necessary.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. And that's exactly what he was hoping for. But he didn't get it because I think the people he wants to convince most, i.e. South Africans, did mm-hmm. not buy it for a second. Mm-hmm. And it was very funny to observe just how swift the international press kind of made corrections to the headlines that they were putting out. I mean, we don't want to take credit for it, but when Africa as a Country first saw the New York Times headline, we sent out a tweet and were like, what the hell? And then, you know, within like 10 minutes, the New York Times made a correction. So, you know, I think the way that happened for me reflects not so much, let's say, willingness or preparedness on the part of international media. That's probably the case give credit to de Klerk, but probably just an inability for international press to kind of read the room in a way. There's kind of a way in which there's a disconnect and there's no real understanding of what the sentiment in South Africa is, the way in which South Africans have for quite an extensive period into our democratic era have problematized that transition period, have problematized the way in which initially we were raised to believe in this sort of rainbow nation narrative, and once apartheid ended, we all just joined hands and worked together in this multiracial joint effort to build a new South Africa. A lot of South Africans understand that that settlement was unequal, it was not a fair bargain, and it's in many ways significantly why so many of those problems persist now, even when we have universal suffrage, even when we have formal equality. There's an economy that is incredibly unequal, and that still does not work for the majority.
Yeah, and you know, just so we're clear too, that if I read correctly, like, he's not going to be receiving a state funeral. Julius Malema, has been very, very, front and center in sort of pushing back against any kind of, you know, stately remembrances of this person. So, yeah, as you were saying, like, the political situation in South Africa is very different from what we're seeing in the international press.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, go ahead, Matt.
Go for it. I kind of got a different question. So if you want to go off that, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the case. He's not receiving a state funeral. President Cyril Ramaphosa is still wanting to declare a period of mourning. And there's a lot of pushback. But something that I think is also important to say is that de Klerk's passing, I think, was something that was talked about frequently in a lot of the, you know, the public sphere dominated by, you know, commentators and people on social media and so on. But there's also, I think it's important to note the way in which, you know, for the majority of the country, just people kind of don't care. Like, there's just a way in which I think South Africa is a place where, precisely because of the extent of our inequality, the majority of South Africans can't really access the public sphere. A lot of South Africans live in tremendous conditions of deprivation, where a lot of the declaratory discourse is dominated by a certain kind of middle class demographic. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the discussion is happening. But for the majority of South Africans, it's just this. Remembering his legacy and problematizing it doesn't really achieve anything. The problems they face are much more pressing. And one thing, in a very kind of cruel and ironic way, I think a lot of the the de Klerk discourse that has been happening, and when it happened, sort of ended up being a distraction for a lot of the immediate domestic problems that we had to face. So it occurred at the same time as our finance minister having to deliver an important speech, sort of announcing what the state's budgetary commitments were going to be in the next period. And in that announcement, presented huge cuts to spending, to housing, to healthcare, to everything in the middle of a devastating social and economic crisis. And that kind of went under the radar because everyone was kind of focused on de Klerk. And in a very cruel way, de Klerk is getting what he wanted, not in terms of how people are remembering him, but if you remember the video that he gave, this insistence that South Africa must subscribe to a sort of neoliberal economic agenda, that is what is happening. That is what the South African government, the liberation government of the ANC, is continuing to pass. So I think also illustrates the degree to which a lot of South Africans' problems today have kind of moved past the legacy of apartheid and are also kind of influenced by contemporary political choices that we make.
It's fascinating to me the sort of wider historical anxiety around these sorts of questions. Like, we have an announcement in Partido Comunista de España in Spain and the Unidas Podemos, amendments to the 1977 amnesty law will allow Francoists to be prosecuted for crimes against humanity. Like, this sort of anxiety against history, and like, this isn't out of character for the New York Times, right? Both in being a sort of counter-revolutionary paper from the foundation, but also its coverage of Africa historically. We'll talk to Milton Alamadi about this in the coming months. He's got a new book about that. But, and also, like, the theory of political change, right? Like, New York Times and its readers are more interested in this being like a nice handshake in the boardroom than what really happened. And it's dangerous, it feels to me. Like, I'm glad to hear that people reject it to the extent that they do.
Absolutely. I think that's totally on point. And, you know, in a way, I think South Africans can also fall prey to that almost. So what I've noticed is that in a lot of the discussion about de Klerk, people immediately kind of contrast him with Mandela. And like, of course, there's no argument there that Mandela was the far greater and more exceptional leader. But I think still this kind of obsession with leadership, so to speak. So the idea that what South Africa needs right now is the kind of leadership that Mandela exhibited, and looking at that video as an example of that, and thinking about that transition period as something decided by individuals in a boardroom coming at loggerheads, and de Klerk mostly being defeated but still having some of his way, I think that can kind of obscure the way in which a lot of the structural questions had no easy answers, and a lot of the structural questions also implicated groups from different sides that bought into de Klerk's vision, and the way in which the ANC steered South Africa into the post-democratic period also reflected a lot of its own vested interests being protected and continuing to be protected and so on. So there's kind of a way in which there's an inability, you know, de Klerk is this villain, right? And everyone can recognize him as such. But when people reflect on villains, there's also this pining for more heroes like Mandela. And I think what a lot of people are still struggling to see since South Africa today is that a lot of our political challenges don't need more Mandelas. You know, a lot of people looked at our current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, as being a figure that could aspire to that. He was one of the lead negotiators in the transition as well. But what it needs is the kind of organizing and the kind of politics that ended apartheid, and that was a politics of from below, and that was people led and people centered, and that's what's missing in South Africa today.
Yeah, I mean, on that, obviously this is a broad question, so take it in whichever way you feel is best. I mean, there were local elections recently that did not go the way of the ANC. you saw some small gains, if I'm correct, for like EFF, and you know, there's movement. But how would you sort of categorize the way that these political shifts are going in the country, right? Because I think that for people in the U.S., particularly like leftists in the U.S., like I don't think there is enough of like a realization of like how much kind of like neoliberal policy unfortunately was like implemented by ANC in power, right? Not always by their own conditions of their own choosing, but you know, nonetheless. And you know, it's still a country that has, you know, mass amounts of inequality, and you know, there's a lot of frustration. So I mean, like, it's 2021, we're coming out of we're still in a pandemic, sorry, like we're still in this massive pandemic. You know, the ANC sort of was struggling in the most recent election, and you're starting to see these different formations come about. I mean, how would you sort of categorize the struggle right now?
I think it's, you know, South Africa's kind of been in the middle of this process where we are seeing the fracture of the National Liberation Project. Mm-hmm. So the ANC, which was once the hegemonic political force in South Africa, sort of embodied people's aspirations for an egalitarian future. I think ever since the 2008 financial crisis, ever since the presidency of Jacob Zuma in 2009, and the way in which the ANC came undone by widespread political patronage and corruption and its factional battles and the tripartite alliance, which it's a part of with the South African Communist Party and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, coming undone with one of the biggest trade unions in COSATU leaving, the Marikana massacre, fees must fall, so on and so forth. There's just been this protracted period in which the ANC has lost political legitimacy. But having said that, there still hasn't been any serious challenges. So the economic freedom fighters, which you mentioned, I think one thing that's interesting about being South Africa is that from afar, a lot of people think of the EFF as being the sort of left party in South Africa. But in many ways, it's kind of just a faction of the ANC, still very much buys into the ANC's political project of wanting to kind of establish a patriotic black bourgeoisie, indigenize South African capitalism, and use that as a vehicle to sort of redistribute wealth somehow, has started to sort of kind of parrot right-wing talking points, anti-immigrant sentiment, so on and so forth. So a lot of these, you know, new entrants into the scene, while the EFF being the primary one, is kind of downstream of the ANC. So in these elections, it's plateaued. It can't break above a certain ceiling because I think a lot of people just sort of don't see it as a serious challenge. It's the ANC, the Democratic Alliance, which has been South Africa's official opposition since 1998, is this political party that presents a kind of classical liberal outlook, and once upon a time tried to transform the leadership of its party, having had this history of being white dominated, to having a lot more black leaders. But then after many political spats and the ostracization of some key black leaders, has kind of doubled down and embraced an identity as being this minoritarian, Republican styled party in South Africa, and no one finds them appealing anymore. So the political landscape at the moment, and what these local government elections illustrated, is that the viable political projects are coming from unpredictable directions. So there's been political parties like this new group called Action SA, which is actually led by a former member of the Democratic Alliance called Herman Mashaba, who was the mayor of Johannesburg, which is the economic hub of South Africa. It's where I live. And he sort of styled himself as a kind of Rudy Giuliani figure, going to clean the streets of foreigners and stuff like that, and then got kicked out of the DA, started his own party, and it's kind of like a five-star movement styled civic populist front, and that's where a lot of the energy is, this sort of like an emerging sort of black kind of right-wing current in South Africa. That's where a lot of the energy is going, and the left in South Africa, I think, is still trying to find its identity outside of the Communist Party, outside of COSATU, outside of the failed NUMSA moment when NUMSA left COSATU and tried to start in a very haphazard fashion its own Workers' Party 2 months before the 2019 general elections. So South African left is still in this kind of moribund wilderness, where it's trying to figure out what to do, how to contest power, and how to do it seriously.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. Anything else before we let you go? William Shockey, Africa is a Country, where will you direct people? The Shockey Spear on Twitter, and I know you guys do put great conversations on YouTube as well as a podcast.
Yeah, so do check out africasacountry.com to see all of our content and critical analysis and commentary on the continent. We run a podcast called AIAC Talk, which I host. Find that on your favorite streaming platform. And we're also in partnership with a bunch of cool publications on the continent, such as Amandla magazine, which is this progressive magazine that everyone should check out if they want to find specific information about South Africa and what's happening here. Check out the Matare Social Justice Center, which is based in Kenya, if you want to get specific information about what's going on there. And yeah, I think that's it.
Well, thanks a lot, and I appreciate you staying up, but we allow you to go to bed if you want to.
No, thanks so much, guys. You know, this stuff keeps me up at night, so it's nice to have a chance
to talk about somebody to talk to. Well, we're always around for you whenever you want, friend.
Appreciate it. Appreciate it.
We'll talk thanks to you so soon. Much.
See you.
Cheers.
That was wonderful. People really should check out Africa as a Country. Not only the political and historical writing is really great, they do a lot of great coverage of sport and culture, which I think is phenomenal. And the podcast is a must listen. It's actually
it's really good.
Highly suggest that. Yep. Well, do we need to go to a break screen, or can we bring Jacob on? We have to get his photograph.
Oh, prepared. Right. Let's go to a break screen, actually.
Yeah, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back in like 30 seconds, y'all.
Yep. All right. Be back. Back, Left Reckoning, joined by Jacob from the Valley Labor Reporters. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Matt, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Always happy to be with y'all.
Yeah, I mean, we got a lot to get to today. I mean, we've been covering and following y'all's lead on this strike at Warrior Met. But we wanted to bring you back on because there's been a lot of, I mean, you know, because when a strike goes on this long, right? You know, there's a lot of just like making sure that people have their eyes on it, know ways that they can support it. And for folks who are watching this on YouTube, we have a link in the show description of ways you can help support the strike fund. But, you know, there's a lot of efforts that are sort of making sure people know that this is still going on. But there's been a lot of developments over the past couple of weeks, specifically legally regarding Warrior Matt. So we wanted to bring you in to sort of help people understand what the state of this strike is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate it. And so I'm happy to talk about that. And the state, you know, the big, one of the big stories is like about the injunctions recently, mm-hmm. but to back up and give everybody just a little bit more background before we go there, you know, strikes are won or lost by like power and its exertion. And so the primary function of a strike is to take revenue and profits from the company by withholding labor. You know, without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn, right? That kind of thing. And so one way to assess how the strike is going is to look at how much it's costing the company. And it's actually costing the company like a lot of money. The Alabama media has, they're basically running with Warrior Mets numbers, which in their last quarterly report, they said that the strike has cost them $6.9 million. And that's what they attribute to like increased security, negotiations, et cetera. But that doesn't count the cost that they attribute to idling an entire mine, which is $9.3 million. And they compare the revenue from this year, which is $38.4 million, to last year, where they had a loss of $14.4 million. And so that looks actually pretty good, but you shouldn't be comparing this year amid like record high metallurgical coal prices to last year, where you had absolutely plummeting demand on top of a pandemic. Mm-hmm. What you should be looking at is 2 years ago about this time. So how are their numbers right now compared to 2 years ago? They're actually down $400 million from where they were this time in 2019. And met coal prices have never been higher. So the strike is costing them a lot, right? But they're not reacting like it's costing them a lot, which is very, very scary, I think, for a lot of people, especially the folks that are actually putting their lives and livelihoods on the line for this. The last contract that Warrior Met offered the union, it gave seniority to scabs, and it did not even guarantee the striking miners their jobs back. So that, I mean, that's not even a deal worth voting on. And so they didn't vote on it, you know, and, and they've said that at the bargaining table, the miners aren't worth what they are getting now. I mean, the like absolute disdain that the company is treating these striking workers with is gross. And they're treating the scabs like royalty on top of all that. They have given them box seats at Alabama games on top of the premium pay that, you know, scabs always get. And they're getting paid lunches, which the striking miners did not get under their old contract. So, you know, all this to say, the company's really dug in their heels. And I think, and a lot of the strikers think that they want to get rid of the union. We're seeing an effort to decertify Exxon workers in Texas. David, you may know more about that than I do. They've been locked out for months, and I don't doubt that at some point we see that at Warrior Met. But, the financial report that they recently released may give us some clues as to why they are acting like this. And it says that they are leveraging their working capital, which is assets that they've got minus the debts that they have, to stay afloat and keep, you know, make sure everything stays above board. And I don't know a whole lot about that working capital and how all that works, to be honest. But I do know that they've got investors at trillion-dollar investing firms. And if they have been able to convince the investors at, say, BlackRock or Fidelity Investments, where they also have some investors, that it would be worth it in the long term to kill the union, then financially speaking, you know, they've got the upper hand. And that means that, you know, the only other way to bring to bear some pressure on Warrior Met is through other means other than the financial means. And we know that the law is stacked against workers in this country. And so that's a good segue into the injunctions. And, you know, they had, there have been a myriad of injunctions basically since the start of the strike. First, it limited picket lines to 11 people, and then it went down to 6, and then it went back up to 10. And that was the progression, I think. And now they have completely banned their right to ban them from picketing in front of Warrior Met entrances. I mean, totally, like, they cannot be there. They've had contractors come and bulldoze the tents that the striking miners had set up. And through all of this, like, we haven't seen any of the Alabama working class defenders log on. And it's really, really pissed me off. I mean, how, like, you, the number of segments on talk radio in the last 8 months about, like, Dr. Seuss or whatever the hell, or crazy yeah. college students, like, they would be innumerable. And I have not heard one single segment. I listen to talk radio a lot. I have not heard one single segment about the strike that I have not been on the air for. Sometimes they'll have me on as guests, and when I talk about this particular thing, they don't berate me and act like I'm stupid. But if I'm not on the air, they don't talk about it, which is just it's crazy. I mean, think about what's going on here. Over the course of the of this 5-year contract, an analysis by the union said that $1.1 billion was taken out of Brookwood and sent to New York investors in the form of, you know, wage cuts and health care and safety cuts and all that. And now you've got scabs from all over the country getting premium pay to come to our state and take their jobs. And where's that money going to go? It's going to go to these other states. It's not going to go to Brookwood, Alabama. And they're spending all this money training people that don't know what the hell they're doing. We can see that from the pollution in the river nearby. There have been a few times that the river has literally turned black because the scabs don't know how to do their damn job. And you've got the government coming in and saying you can't even pick it. Amidst all this, even in the last 3 weeks when they have completely banned picketing, you've still got people talking about cancel culture. 2 days after the injunction to ban picketing, a talk host on one of the stations that we're on wrote an article about, and I had to go back and look this up to see exactly what it is, because it was so stupid, saying that we are in the digital French Revolution and cancel culture is the guillotine.
Oh, yeah, baby. I'm Robespierre.
And it was literally about culture war stories that you'd expect to have seen on, like, skeptic YouTube channels in 2015. It was about incidences in, like, Oberlin College and Cambridge. Oh, I mean, this is an Alabama talk radio host, like, talking about Oberlin. Like, who gives a shit? I don't. And on Twitter, she had the gall to say that concern about one thing isn't mutually exclusive from another. Which I'm like, okay, well, that's great. If you care about both of these things, maybe you should talk about the other thing. And she never replied, and she never talked about the other thing. And this is the same thing that Emily Jasinski said. She's like some hack at the Federalist. She also does Rising now. Mm-hmm. And when I challenged, she replied to, like, Glenn Greenwald on Twitter or something about how it's been saddening to see the labor movement turned from a genuinely working class movement to a yuppie one. I was like, okay, so Miss, you know, apparently you know about the labor movement. Where are you talking about the miner strike that's in its 8 months and where picketers have been banned from their right to freely assemble and speak their minds? She deflected and said that they talked about Bessemer, and also she did one podcast about frontline workers. The only Bessemer article that I could find in the Federalist basically gloated about the results and said that the union was too much in line with the Democratic Party, which I told y'all that, you know, Bessemer is a city that voted 70% for Joe Biden, and black women in the state of Alabama voted 98% for Doug Jones in 2017. And this Amazon facility is majority black women. Okay, so this is not like whatever critiques you want to make about that campaign, the issue was obviously not they're too Democrat, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't track with anything happening on the ground. And so anyway, that's the notes that I had on the miner strike and the things that I wanted to bring up. So, I'm so frustrated because the gall that they have to keep talking about cancel culture amidst the state the state coming down and say, you can't be on public property and protest your employer. The gall that they've got to continue talking about cancel culture amidst that and to not mention it. I mean, I could not imagine being such boot-licking, scab-loving scum. Like, holy crap.
I don't know, David, if you can look at my most recent posted tweet. You inspired me to post something that's been bugging me for a while, which is that Will Witt, who is this little youngster, kind of the Prager, Dennis Prager realizes he can't be the face of PragerU forever. He's got this little guy, Will Witt, to come do it. And a few months ago, he had tweeted this out. So it's not like they're unaware of BlackRock, for instance, right? Your future in America is being destroyed and controlled by BlackRock. And this was a response to BlackRock is buying every single family house they can. This story is about BlackRock buying up all the property, right? But right. Nowhere are they. Again, when they could be supporting these workers against BlackRock, right? And it's even right. And even better, they're coal workers, right? They should be all right. Over the fossil fuel angle of this too. And of course, they are for the bosses. Fundamentally, that's who they're always going to be for.
This is a metallurgical coal mine. It's used in the production of steel. It's not actually like energy stuff.
Fair.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can't, like, I don't know how you're like, there are so many good ways to talk about this as a conservative and keep your like bootlicking cred or whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And they refuse to do it. They absolutely refuse to do it. And, you know, I mentioned that the way that they're going to have to win this strike is to bring other pressure to bear than financial pressure. It seems to me. Mm-hmm. And, talk radio hosts in this state were able to kill a toll bridge in Mobile, like, just by them being pissed about it, you know? Mm. This was a project in Mobile, which is good, you know? I mean, tolls are bad, right? Okay, so good on the talk radio hosts, sure. But they were able to do that almost single-handedly, and because I don't know, for whatever reason, they took an interest in it. And so it, like... I believe that if you could get even just one of these, you know, dumbasses on talk radio to really pick up the mantle and push, push Warrior Met, get their audiences pissed off about it, talk to the political leaders in the state to put some pressure on. I really think that if they wanted to do something for, I mean, a lot of these families are conservative. If they wanted to do something for conservative working families in rural Alabama, they could do it. And they could help bring back $1.1 billion to this rural community from, you know, these, you know, fancy smancy liberal New York elites and give it back to good working families in Alabama. But like, they won't do it. And I mean, they have only, Yellowhammer News is this right wing media outlet. And the only things that they have published about the site has literally been reprints of Warrior Met press releases. Wow. I mean, insane.
Well, on this, I don't want to come, because I don't know well enough at like AL.com, right? But I wanted to share this article right quick with everybody, because I think that the way that even this injunction again, and like if people miss this the first time, you got to understand what's going on. This judge is telling people that they cannot exercise their First Amendment right to protest their employer who has been abusing them for years and years, right? This is like you worked about free speech. This is clear as day.
Right.
But this article here, like in the headlines well enough, right, it says striking Alabama coal miners asked a judge to prohibit guns for those driving past picket line, right? Which is very reasonable. And I think
that my picture's still up on the YouTube just for the
Yeah, I got it for the record. Just now. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, appreciate it.
Yeah. So the headline I think got changed a little bit earlier today. But if you go through this article, it takes a very long time for them to start actually talking about what's being done to the workers, like the threats that they've endured, the fact that people have driven into the picket line with trucks. Instead, you're getting all this kind of talk about property damage to people's cars, right? And that's like all the way up until the very, 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 very end, right? Oh, the union thugs came and they hurt a car. Meanwhile, like people are literally getting, you know, there's video of people on the picket line having trucks just flying right into them. So, you know, like even on this level right here, you know, this is news, supposed to be unbiased, etc. Like they're kind of both sizing of this thing is making it seem like, you know, potentially some property damage done to a car here or there, right? Versus like actual people, you know, slamming trucks into people standing on the road. You know, those are two very, very different things, in my opinion. You know, so like the media criticism is, you know, like beyond people, if you're not getting it from talk radio, and then even the kind of neutral arbiters right here are trying to make it seem like, well, both sides have like legitimate grievances with each other, is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Well, so there's a local news station that went with so Warrior Met, and Kim Kelly has been all over this. She's been doing a really good job. She recently put out an article about this big press event that Warrior Met did about the violence on the picket line coming from the striking workers. And there, CBS 42 is a local TV station, and they came out and did some picket line interviews about this. And, the striking miners told me, and which I emailed the guy and tweeted at him like multiple times, and he never confirmed or denied it. So I'm just going to assume it's true, because if it wasn't true, he would have told me, right? They told me that he and his cameraman were both almost hit by scabs going too fast across the picket line. Jeez. And the story was still about how the striking miners are too violent. And it's like, dog, you were almost hit, man. And you're like, how do you still go with that story?
Yeah.
Like, how? Oh my God. I can't, like, it's crazy to me. So you're absolutely right that the neutral arbiters in the state are not even properly both sidesing it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you could say, I mean, the proper both sides is that it, like, the factual reporting of what's happening is there were no reported instances that I'm aware of any property damage from union folks until they started hitting them with cars. And now, you know, before and after that, there were like Jack Rocks and stuff. And so, you know, whatever. That's fine. That's all good. Jack Rocks are good. But the proper, like, neutral reporting would be like, okay, look, you know, there were people that were hit by cars, and in some of those, the instances where the Warrior Met put out this big long video about the violence, the miners have videos, some of those videos in full, and in some of them you actually see like, this car that they blow out, that they knocked out the window of, they tried to hit somebody. So, you know, I mean, yeah. It's just, and nobody in the quote unquote, you know, neutral arbiter type press, AL.com, CBS 42, all these local news stations, none of them are reporting it like that. All of them are putting the quote unquote union violence at the forefront. They're not talking about in these articles about union violence, about the more systemic violence that, you know, stealing money from natural resources that are ours as Alabamians, yeah. Frankly, and pulling it and giving it to billionaires in New York, you know, I mean, that's it's not contextualized. It's astounding, and it's even worse in the conservative press somehow. But yeah, you're absolutely right, David.
This reminds me of a section, and it's always the test that I put on for conservative, especially conservative populist sort of propaganda. This is from essay "England, Your England" by George Orwell that David and I talked about in a Patreon episode. But the quote goes this: "The British ruling class, we're not altogether wrong in thinking that fascism was on their side. It is a fact that any rich man, unless he is a Jew, has less to fear from fascism than from either communism or democratic socialism. One not ever to forget this, for nearly the whole of German and Italian propaganda is designed to cover it up." And like, that's the thing, is like, you can talk about BlackRock when it's getting in the way of like home ownership for people. But when it comes to actually their bankrolling, strike busting, like, you got nothing to say, because, like, you know, we know, you know, who's funding PragerU, for instance.
Oh, yeah, of course. And I mean, it's not even like, this isn't even a, like, quote unquote liberal union or anything. You know, I mean, if you were talking about the Machinist Union, maybe you could say, oh, the Machinists endorsed Joe Biden, blah, 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 whatever. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. The UMWA did not endorse Joe Biden. They pretty rarely endorse, actually. And I mean, this is, you know, they try to stay because, you know, I think some people, you know, they understand that, you know, Republicans want to kill them and Democrats aren't super favorable to them because they're coal miners. And so, you know, a lot of times they kind of stay out of the, like the electoral type stuff. So, you know, this, you can't even say that like you could about even a lot of other blue collar unions that, oh, they donate to this or that Democrat politics. Like, it's just bootlicking for the, but like, there's no other explanation that I can see about it. Mm-hmm. You know, one person told me that they just don't find it interesting. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't find it interesting? You talk about like much less interesting crap all the time. And, yeah. And Dr. Seuss. Like, Yeah, sure, sure. It's not interesting. Yeah, okay.
Okay, David, did you have any comment on the economic underpinnings of this? Like, why don't they give a F?
What, the ruling, like the conservative movement?
Well, they're blowing $400 million because of this, right? Like.
Well, I think money's cheap right now,
right,
man.
Okay, yeah.
So it's like the ability, especially now that it is so. And one, like ownership is, from what I understand, is dispersed. Like BlackRock owns like a 14% stake in WireMap, but it's like a few other.
And they're the largest investor.
Yeah, BlackRock, for sure.
Is. And
which
they
is
only
no small thing. And, but I'm saying, yeah, is like there's a few financial corporate companies in, you know, in New York who all own stakes in it, and money is really cheap right now. And if you can just sit on a mine, mm-hmm, for a bit of time, you might be losing some in the short term, but like your ability right now to just sort of borrow, and especially for, you know, an organization like BlackRock, you know, they can wait it out almost as like an investment in the future, right?
Right. Yeah, and I mean, that's, it seems like that's what they're doing. You know, I mean, you mentioned like 14% is not a lot when you're talking about, you know, that's the maximum ownership that any single investment firm has. And so, you know, as part of the effort to try to put some other pressure on them, they're doing this big, actually, International Day of Action tomorrow. They're going to have people protesting in front of BlackRock, in front of Fidelity in D.C., in front of some investor in Australia. So, you know, I mean, they're really trying to ramp up the campaign, but they are seeing absolutely zero love from Republicans. And frankly, they're not seeing enough love from Democrats here in the state. I mean, there's one Democrat that has, as of May, He's been pretty good. Chris England, he's the chair of the Democratic Party. He is also in the State House of Representatives. And he's been doing pretty good about being at the strike. He spoke at multiple events. He has helped fundraise. And the Democratic Party has actually used their email list, I think. They have. They've used their email list to send out for donations for the strike fund. So there's some good stuff, but like... Chris is the only elected Democrat that's really been out front and center on this. And like, I don't understand it, you know, because this is 1,000 people that are, that they're willing to like forego a paycheck for this thing that they believe in. And, you know, as entrenched as people's political beliefs are, they're not like immovable. And if you can convince 1,000 people in Brookwood, which is not a very large place, if you can convince 1,000 people in Brookwood that that you're on their side, I think that has ramifications in at least 2022. You know, they're going to remember it in 12 months. They've already been on strike almost a year. You know, they're going to remember this when, because in 2022, state house and state senate races are up. And you've got those 1,000 people, you've got all their families, you've got all their friends, you've got, you know, it would be a really big political winner, it seems to me, if the Democrats just went all in on this and basically mimicked everything that I'm saying about, like, oh, the Republicans, they say they care about coal miners, but look, they're leaving you high and dry. But here we are, Democrats, we're coming out and we're supporting you, doing every single thing that we can. We're trying to do this and we're trying to do that. And they're here and there, yeah. You know, it's just not as much as it should be. This should be their issue for the next, until the strike is over. They basically should talk about nothing else because they can't do anything else. They're in the super minority. There's literally the only thing they can do is message. And so like, pick a good message.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's funny that just just nationally, the conversation among Democrats is like, gosh, we need an issue. We need this issue. What's the issue going to be for 2020? And we have these just a massive wave of strikes going on.
Right.
And neither party, like you say, like Democrats are here and there to do just enough. And like, God bless the politicians that are doing enough. But like, again, it's like no connection between like the Monday or the Sunday talk shows. And like, oh, what does this mean for the Democrats in 2022? And just this massive, you know, issue going on right now, and it really is a testament to how much capital controls both parties. I think
it's really flat because and none of the strikes that we are seeing are these people like the none of these unions skew like crazy Democrat or left wing. Mm-hmm. Right, we're talking about John Deere workers and Kellogg's plant workers, which maybe the Kellogg's plant workers are going to be more low-wage minority immigrant people, and so maybe there would be like not a whole lot of gain to be had there. But like a lot of these strikes are like among pretty conservative constituencies, generally speaking, especially among the labor movement. And there's so much, it seems to me, to be won electorally. And they're just leaving it on the table. They're totally leaving it on the table. And I can't, I mean, really, especially, there's absolutely no excuse for like the state level Democrats in Alabama to not be making this their issue, because what are they doing? They fought for like 2 days about redistricting, which was bad, and the ACLU is suing the state for it because the districts are so gerrymandered. But like, they're not gonna win.
Yeah,
you know, they're not gonna win. These gerrymandered seats are gonna go through, and so what are you gonna do for the next like 12 months? Before you're elected, like, you don't have anything else to do. The Republicans are, they don't need you for anything. The Republicans do not need the Democrats in the state for a single solitary damn thing. And so, like, they're just sitting on their ass. Like, I don't even know what they do all day, to be honest. Like, all these people and politicians and communications directors, all these people that are getting a salary somehow to supposedly be fighting for working people in Alabama. Like, I have no idea what they do all day. Yeah,
I'll tell you, they do the same thing they're doing across the South, which is like reading, you know, reports about how demographics are destiny, all while they're bleeding votes and supports among working people of all races. I mean, it's wild, and it's extremely frustrating. I want to play a minute of this clip. This is because I love. I hope the pressure works. I mean, it's frustrating, as you're saying, that like there isn't not enough of a political home for it, you know, in Alabama yet. But I do love the idea of taking these fights directly to, you know, BlackRock, standing out front of their offices, if nothing else, just to make those people who go in every day 9 to 5 see the shit that they're doing to other people.
Yep. Right.
But I also think it's a very powerful image, and I think more and more people need to stop seeing capital as some kind of, I don't know, immaterial spiritual force that resides elsewhere, and start to see it as like some, no, things that like exist in buildings and there's people behind it, etc.
Yeah.
But anyways, you can pick any one of these clips here, but this is Brian Sanson, secretary, treasurer of the UMWA, talking. This is captured by Kim Kelly, who, as we've noted before, is a must follow, has been doing amazing work covering this.
They have ran him over, they have attacked him in every way possible. And the state police, the county sheriffs, the governor, and BlackRock have sat around and watched this happen and not done a daggone thing about it. Well, we got a message for these hedge funds, mutual funds, and executives, Vanguard, BlackRock, Fidelity, L1 Capital, they're in Australia. We got a message for L1 Capital, too. We haven't forgot about you guys. We got some union miners in Australia coming to visit you all real soon. Larry Fink, CEO of BlackRock, $28 million last year. Yeah, that money come off a bank of coal miners in Alabama.
Yeah.
Good old Larry likes to tell folks, you know, he cares about the world. He's a social democrat. He cares what's going on. Brothers and sisters, I submit to you, he's not a good Democrat, he's not a good Republican, and he's not a good human being for sitting around and watching what's going on down in Alabama. Got a state judge in Alabama that put this injunction on us, 350 yards from the picket line, that trying to break the union. Well, we're going to test his resolve, and we're going to test his interpretation of the United States Constitution, because we have a right to pick it. We're going to pick at these investors.
Yes.
We're going to pick at these coal mines.
Yes.
And we're going to do it every day until we get a fair and just contract.
Yes.
For the workers of Warrior Met.
Yeah. I mean, that's good shit.
I mean, it's good. It's like making all the connections. That, I mean, no, if nothing, I think this is a clear lesson, and the people involved certainly know this. I'm saying for people watching, like, there's a very clear line, a clear moment where we're seeing that we don't have friends in high places.
Yeah.
We only got each other, though, and it's a beautiful thought to think of, you know, international solidarity there too, with folks in Australia showing up and protesting mm-hmm. against these companies. And people should know, like, Australia, that company, L1 or whatever, like, they own a lot of mines around the world. And they're heavily invested in these kind of industries, and they do this everywhere, mm-hmm. right? And it's just like, I don't know. These fights are, you know, can feel very regional and local, but they're big and international and involve all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is the advantage that these big people have, because they're so dispersed. You know, if you've got one guy that lives like down the road from you, and he's like real big and rich, and he owns whatever, and you know, it's easy to like, and he owns 100% of whatever, you know, it's mm-hmm. easy to make him feel pressure. But if you've got one guy in this place, he owns 14% of the thing. And then this other guy, and it's not even one guy, BlackRock's not even one. It's like, yeah. this team of like people that live off of like ripping profits out of communities. I mean, you know, it's so dispersed, and it makes the targets difficult, and it makes it difficult to like even have these fights or conceptualize them. And it's a really big problem. And, you know, that's why as much as I hate that aspect of it, the political and electoral aspect of it, I loathe to talk about it, and I don't most of the time, but it is still important. One of the things that unions would say when they're trying to get their members to vote is that you can lose what you get in your contract at the ballot box. So, mm. you know, these kinds of, you know, that's not my, the electoral stuff is certainly not my focus, and I really don't talk about it a lot. But, you know, like it's important, and it has an impact on people's lives. And like, the people that are involved in electoral politics, like, they need to recognize that, and especially the people that are elected or that are on staffs of like elected office of elected officials and stuff. Like, I don't think there's enough recognition that like the inaction that politicians are taking in Alabama, and the affirmative action against them and the inaction for them is really having an effect on people's lives, and it's hurting people, and it's hurting communities. And like, I mean, they can't understand that. If they understood that, I don't see how they could do it.
Yeah. I mean, I think you put it well. I mean, there's so much we could get into, but I think we might have to table it for another time to do a deep dive into Alabama history and all that kind of stuff. We have a link for people to support the strike fund below.
I wanted to ask about that, actually. Like, so, you know, we've seen how fundraising has changed the electoral side of politics. And, you know, what's the sort of assessment of, you know, fundraising for Warrior Met? You know, we definitely like want to promote this basically every week, and like we said, this offer we made last week still mm-hmm. stands, that if you get a free retweet for David and I if you donate to one of these strikes. So but yeah, like, what's your sense of that? Has that changed? What's like, how vital is it?
I think it's important, but I think when you think about these strike funds and the amount that they're raising, and then you compare it to the numbers of people on strike, it really, to me, underscores the importance of planning on the part of the unions and long-term strategy. Because the most that we've seen, that I've seen any strike fund receive, is the ones for the coal miners in Alabama, and they've gotten $1 million from a bunch of different from you know, small dollar donors. There was, I think, the UFCW donated $100,000. Of course, we raised about $75,000, and there are several other unions, and then there's some small dollar donors. And even if we say 1.5, even if we say $2 million, I don't think they're quite there, but let's say $2 million just for math. That's $2,000 per miner. You know, that's not a lot, especially over the course of 8 months. And the union has been paying, the union estimates their weekly cost for the strike is like $2 million because the union is paying for the health care. The union is giving them $400 a week, which is the largest strike benefit checks that any union gives their striking workers that I'm aware of, which maybe it could be bigger, maybe not. You know, there are certainly conversations to be had there, but you cannot sustain this kind of thing. That's why dues are important. You can't sustain this kind of thing on donations and charity from people. You have to, it has to be planned. It has to be organized. And that's why dues and strike funds are important. There are some unions that don't take enough advantage of it. Like the UAW has I think tens of millions of dollars in their strike fund, maybe even $100 million, something. I mean, it's like an insane amount of money in their strike fund. And they're very loath to use it. And it's like, I mean, the money's there for something. Of course you want to save. But you know, in times like these, you should be being like, okay, yeah, we're going to like fund half of the workers' salaries and like, screw you, you know, like in times like these, it seems like you should really be going balls to the wall. But whatever the strategy is, you know, I'm not privy to those kind of conversations. Charity and strike funds and stuff like that from donations from outside folks, it can't make it. Like, at best, you can, you know, you're going to be able to like buy people dinner a couple times a week, right.
you know I think it's important to realize the limitations of it too, while also, you know, finding, you know, if you're able to, you know, helping out. But I mean, it just sort of exposes, and I don't want to derail by talking about annoying people in particular, but just sort of shows like the kind of infrastructure and support networks and strategizing and organizing that is necessary to win these kind of battles with capital are immense. You know, people who sort of throw around terms and concepts like general strike, I think sort of need to wrestle with like the actual functional logistics. Cause you know, unfortunately these things have a lot more, you know, to them than just willpower. I mean, if it was just willpower alone, I think Jacob would be able to pull them over the finish line. You know, but you know, we need to understand, like, there's kind of unglamorous work that goes into being able to support, you know, ourselves as members of the working class in these like prolonged fights with capital. And if we want to win, if you want to be on the big stage too, you have to start putting in the work now to be able to build those networks out.
Absolutely. I mean, it's that kind of stuff is so important, and you can't do it ad hoc, and you can't do it without long term strike. I saw like a tweet, you know, about that general strike. Somebody was like, "Well, if everybody just gave $5, we could have a big general strike fund." I'm like, if everybody gave $5 and we did a general strike, everyone would get $5. Like, I minus the administration cost. Like, what do you, I don't. What do you mean? Like, how is this working exactly?
Pass Abe Lincoln to the person on your right.
It's called the velocity of money in economics.
So, right. You know, it's kind of, I mean, that's kind of the amount of thought that goes into these summits and things, and it shows, you know, the seriousness of you know, stuff like having tens of millions of dollars in your strike fund. That took, you know, years and years and decades of people, tens of thousands of people giving $40 a month, $50 mm-hmm. a month in dues, mm-hmm. like 1% of their paycheck every month. It took years of that to be able to get to where, like, okay, we can go on strike and, like, not die of starvation, you know? You can't manufacture that kind of thing out of whole cloth. It has to be like strategized and a long-term kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, Jacob, I really appreciate you joining us and giving us this insight. People should definitely be following the Valley Labor Report. Buy the hat. I get compliments on the hat all the time. I watch the show. Thank you so much, for joining us and for the work that you're doing there, like on the airwaves. I think it's really important to be able to reach people where they're at, and I'm very happy to be able to do things with you.
I appreciate it, y'all. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. And unfortunately, we are sold out of the hats right now.
Sorry, don't mean to cause trouble.
We're going to be, we've got some merch dropping soon that I'm really excited about. I don't know if y'all know Tabitha Arnold, but she's done something for us that's really, really cool that I'm excited to share with people. If you want to support us on, the best way to do that is throwing us some money on PayPal or Patreon or something like that. We're going to be on 5 commercial stations come December, which is really, really cool. And we could definitely use the support. There's at least one person in the labor movement who's not super fond of us here in Alabama, and he's been trying to get unions to not sponsor the show anymore. So, you know, any help would definitely be appreciated for sure.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you, Jacob.
Thank you, Jacob.
All right. Thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
Peace.
No, that was a lot of fun.
We'll have Jacob back for the Alabama overview.
We'll have to get Comrade David on again. Him and I are in a little friendly BBQ battle. We're trying to plan out one. We're going to do that sometime. Texas versus Bama, you know what I mean?
Oh, right.
They do things very differently down there. I think we should do this Gould thing before we jump to the post one.
Yeah. So this is, we do a lot of bum steers. Yeah. On the show. This is a golden calf. I just keep needing to look into the meaning of golden calf. It's just a phrase I've heard, and it might mean something bad. But anyway, this is a stone cold lock. A book mm-hmm. you definitely need to read is The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould. It came out in either the late 70s or early 80s, a response to Charles Murray, who was literally started as like a CIA counterintelligence guy in Southeast Asia. Charles Murray's bell curve, a response to the bell curve. And so we have first, what's prompting this, is Ben Shapiro has taken up the soft Charles Murray mantle. We'll kind of see the way he's like finessing it a little bit, but they can't resist this IQ stuff, which mm-hmm. we know is a very limited metric that
it's bogus, frankly.
Yeah. Right. Like it basically measures how well you are at following instructions. And I was looking at like Mensa, somebody on Mensa fill in whatnot, an IQ test, and it's all like shape, it's geometry, like mm-hmm. puzzles, like for like first graders and stuff like that. Like the idea that that would define who should run society is an insanely almost like a fundamentalist type of view, like a technocratic fundamentalism that's very, I think, weird in people who aren't like oligarchs that are using it to like justify.
Not only is it short-sighted, not only is it racist, it's fundamentally like an undemocratic way to look at the world and other people. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the science is bogus. The motivations are anti-human and racist. Mm-hmm. And then what people want to do with it is extremely anti-democratic, right? So it's a bad force on all of those measures.
Yeah. So before we get to Gould, let's play this Ben Shapiro clip.
Yes, so we got a little Ben here.
He has a very high IQ. And trust me, I'm a gifted kid because I was doing YouTube at age 12.
And it's going to work out this time. Here we go.
So the California guidelines could overhaul the way many school districts approach math instruction. The draft rejected the idea of naturally gifted children, recommended against shifting certain students into accelerated courses in middle school, and tried to promote high-level math courses that could serve as alternatives to calculus, like data science or statistics. Okay, so first of all, if you reject the idea of naturally gifted children, it's because you're an idiot. Some kids are gifted, period, end of story. Some kids have higher IQs than others. And shock of shocks, it turns out that there is a heavy, heavy genetic component to that. That if both parents are neuroscientists, there's a good shot that their kid is going to have a higher IQ than somebody, both of whose parents are on welfare. Okay, that is just... I'm not saying that's inevitably true. There are many smart people who are on welfare, I'm sure. They're not all that many stupid neuroscientists, but they're, I'm sure, smart people on welfare.
What's up?
But if you have to take the average person, and all you know about them is child of two neuroscientists versus child of two people on welfare in a free American society, and all you have to go on is that, whose kid do you think is going to have the higher IQ? Okay, so to pretend that that doesn't exist in real life is stupid. It's just dumb. It's like saying that two tall parents are not likely to have a height-gifted child. How could we possibly say that some people are more height-gifted than others? To pretend that intelligence isn't inborn at all, and we are all sort of tabula rasa, is silly. It's just not true by any available metric. Okay, but this is what California wanted to teach. They recommended against shifting students into accelerated courses, and because they want to punish skill sets. They want to defeat the skillsocracy. The last thing you want to do is reward people who are gifted, who, by the way, should use their gifts on behalf of society in a free market society. Free markets allow people to distribute the uses of their gifts widely. Yeah, this is the magic of free markets.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ben, you could trot little Ben out in defense of King George himself, right? I mean, like, the kind of idea that, like, oh, there's holy blood, great blood, and, you know, great parents that sort of put people in a certain position is, like, I mean, like, dropping even kind of what we're going to get to in a second with Gould and, like, you know, are the wonders of modern science. I mean, this is not even, frankly, like, a unique argument. This is a very old, actually pro-monarchy, you know, pro-entrenched power argument. I just want to say right quick on the point about gifted programs, right? You know, he keeps on bringing up this neuroscientist, you know, example. And the reality with that is what is much more important, frankly, than people's, you know, education achievement is the fact that that is a part, you know, part of society that makes good money. And I think that that actually reflects much more about what the gifted and talented programs were about. It was not about, oh, we need to select people with the best aptitude. It was wealthy people being against the idea of public education and wanting their children to be sort of pulled out of the classroom with the, you know, with the rabble, with the rest of us, so that they could get kind of specialized learning, you know, to help them advance even more, right? I mean, like, the idea that, I don't know. I mean, from everything that we've seen and all the studies that have been done on, like, these gifted programs, they don't seem like they do much in terms of, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, like, when I see, like, gifted kids, it's like, this caused me actually some kind of alienation from my cohort of classmates. Yeah. And if there was half as much, like, if that was about trans people, like, Ben Shapiro would be testifying in front of Congress about how this needs to be stopped, right? Like that's basically the message out of that. And the other thing is like, just to go off on a few things, you get your 23andMe results back, it's not going to tell you, hey, you're genetically a neuroscientist, right? right? That's not genetics. There's not a math gene either. And here's the little truth. If you want to find a predictive metric that will predict, like, people's attainment and success in life, it's not IQ, it's called zip code. Zip code absolutely determined, it'd be way more predictive than any of the caliper metrics that these folks have in this new data science world where, you know, now we can actually see this stuff and, oh, look, this person is genetically just a mathematician. That's silly.
And, access to resources, access to schools that you don't have to walk through metal detectors in the morning. I mean, you know, it's just like, it's a completely, I don't know. It's just an amazing kind of argument that this is just solely, or you know, the like genetics is like the one factor when it comes to human intelligence. Again, something that is extremely difficult, you know, to measure in and of itself.
Again, because genetics aren't changing, and IQ scores continue
also,
rising.
We're not using IQ scores to get people in the gifted classes either.
Right. No, exactly. That's true. But just to like say like the ridiculousness of IQ, right? The IQ scores across any population, regardless of if you join it by race or whatever, right, have been going up for ages. There's a difference that is environmentally determined. And Flynn, I can't remember what his first name is, but he's the guy who coined the term the Flynn effect, which is describing, hey, it looks like people's IQs just go up, up, and up, regardless, right? Himself says, it may be the case that, for instance, like Charles Murray's favorite target, black people, are, and this probably isn't the case, right? There's probably genetically, in science, you take the null hypothesis unless you have reason to believe otherwise. So it's probably the case that there's a big genetic component differentiating, say, Asian people and white people and black people, right? Mm. But Flynn says, like, it could be, for all we know and where the science is now, and this is people who care about IQ, and which I don't give a fuck about it, right? But this is just even, like, the IQ folks, right? That even, like Sam Harris will supposedly defer to sometimes, even though he won't in, I think, significant areas, but we're not going to get into Sam Harris right now. But they say that any of these gaps that, like, Ben Shapiro's fixating on in attainment very easily could be and probably are entirely environmental and not some sort of genetic thing based on race, which is, again, like, race is a very like, we're genetically the same. Race is a political project more than it is a actual biological reality. But anyway, let's play we got the expert here.
Yeah, this is a phenomenal clip.
Why do you think American society is so obsessed with IQ?
I don't know that we're obsessed by it, but I think it arises largely in the context of the lamentable history of our racism. I don't know that it's as much an issue in more homogeneous societies, but we have a situation based on the legacy of racism and continued oppression of people of African descent in this country that has led, for social reasons, to poor average performance of blacks on these tests. That doesn't tell you why it happens, but in a basically racist climate in a country with a strong racist history, I suppose it's not surprising that particularly conservative social thinkers would try to relate poor performance of blacks to intrinsic biological limits. As I like to put it, the quick critique of the bell curve is that it's based upon four assumptions, all of which have to be true. If any one of them is false, the whole argument collapses. First, there has to be a meaningful single number that can be given to intelligence. I think that's false. Secondly, you have to be able to rank people in a single linear order upon it, and that order has to then correlate with social attributes, whether you go to prison or not, whether you have children out of wedlock, etc., your income. Thirdly, that number has to be highly heritable. And fourthly, it has to be unchangeable, or effectively unchangeable. A lot of people confuse the third and the fourth. They assume that if something's heritable, it means it's unchangeable, but that's false. Suppose the first three were true, and they're not. I mean, suppose there was a legitimate number, and you could rank people, and it was highly hereditary. It still could be very mutable. For example, the obvious example is I may have an inherited defect of vision, which is 100% inherited, and I go to the drugstore and I buy a pair of eyeglasses and my vision is fine. I mean, it could be, all those things could be true about intelligence, but the equivalent of buying the pair of eyeglasses, namely programs of remedial education, might boost IQ, and then the whole argument would collapse.
Yeah. I mean, he's one of the greatest of all time. The Mismeasure of Man, it's available in audiobook form. It's a great, great listen. And it's going to be increasingly relevant, honestly. Like, this stuff is very... It's just simply a necessity for hierarchies. This is hierarchy maintenance. Oh, you're muted, David.
No, just saying, I think so, too.
With that, folks, I think we might saunter over to the post-game show.
Yeah, y'all, we got a lot coming. We got some Beto. We got the University of Austin. What do you call it? The Texodus?
University of Austin, Texodus.
I love it. plus people's questions from the Discord. We're going to be having a bonus episode for patrons up this Sunday. Matt and I are going to be doing another reading series. And next Wednesday, we won't be doing the same kind of live show, but we have a great, and it's a long interview, a great conversation with Lillian Chicharia, who is the co-host of What's Left of Philosophy podcast. She's going to be joining us to talk about the question about whether or not Marxism is economic determinism realized. It's a very fun conversation. Towards the end, we get into a little bit of everyone's least favorite, skull measurer, want to be.
Which one? I'm sorry, I lost track.
Oh, James Lindsay, friend.
Oh, of course, yes, that's
you
right.
You know, I mean, he's somebody, I don't know, but we're just prepping for people for this, but he's someone who gets pink in the cheeks about thinking about himself being on the front lines in the fight against communism.
Yeah, paging when through really Hegel.
He's just this sort of like, screaming to a bunch of clapping seals and doing weird axe dances. But we have a little bit of him towards the end there, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's always good to go into James Lindsay as... You know, Chris Rufo, who's supposed to be the polite James Lindsay, is calling for Lane Siege to universities. It's funny, like, the arc that these guys always go on, which is, like, they're the reasonable, J.D. Vance or Brett Weinstein, like, they're reasonable, like, I just have concerns about, like, okay, you're really concerned about the race essentialism that occasionally creeps into CRT, really, that's the part that you're concerned about, or really, like, they're concerned that race essentialism has, for one time been pointed against white people, which I agree, the race essentialism when it creeps in is bad, but really, it's we hate the race essentialism that's pointed against white people this time. Anyway, it's a fun conversation. And What's Left is a of Philosophy's podcast. I'm looking forward to catch up on next week on our break because, it's been a while since I've been philosophical, but it's always when I go home for breaks and, I'm kind of around the family a little bit more. I go into the Philosophy Bites. There's one Thanksgiving and that sort of stuff. So I'm going to do that this week.
A little time off will be good for sure. Yeah. But we're not there yet, y'all. So see y'all on the other side in a little bit, 25 minutes or so in the post game.
Yep.
See y'all there.
Peace.